Pretty awesome words that we've just been singing, aren't they? This is all I really want to do? Well, if you're like me and you think seriously about the words of hymns, you find yourself telling a lot of lies. I remember when I was about 14, my favorite hymn was, and still is, one of my favorite hymns, Beneath the Cross of Jesus. And the second stanza says, I take, O cross, thy shadow for my abiding place. I ask no other sunshine than the sunshine of thy face. And I thought to myself at the age of 14, how can I sing a song like that? I can think of all kinds of sunshine I want besides the sunshine of his face. I certainly wanted marriage, and I wanted motherhood, and I wanted children, and lots of other things. But I began then, and I still do this, to pray that the Lord will help me to be able to sing the words honestly. I see them as goals towards which I mean to move. And it's very easy when we sit in a lovely group like this of very nice people in a very nice place to say, this is all I really want to do. And then when you go out and find that you have a flat tire in your car or something's happened to one of your children, you wonder why that happens. And the Lord can only say to you then, everything that happens fits into a pattern for good to them that love God. Now, if you love me, you will see this as from my hand. You don't have to see the pattern. People are always saying to me, but I don't see how such and such fits in. And the poor lady the other day who said that her husband is homosexual, I don't see how this is ever going to be any good for anybody. And as we talked, I tried to help her to see that one holy life can have untold effects. Our business is simply to be holy. And I thought of the poem that Amy Carmichael wrote when she had prayed that God would give her fire words. God promised to Jeremiah, I think it was, he said, I will make my words in thy mouth as a fire. And Amy, of course, was a writer. She wrote about 40 books, 14 of which are still in print, and you should run, not walk, to your nearest bookstore and get all the Amy Carmichael books you can get your hands on. But she prayed this same prayer, that God would make her words fire words, and God's answer she put into this poem. Thou shalt have words, but at this cost, that thou must first be burnt. Burned by red embers from a secret fire, scorched by fierce heats and withering winds that sweep through all thy being, carrying thee afar from old delights. Doth not the ardent fire consume the mountain's heart before the flow of fervent lava? Wouldst thou easefully, as from cool, pleasant fountains, flow in fire? And I want to talk to you about one of my spiritual mothers. I've been blessed to have many of them. In fact, I think I'll probably get around to telling you about more than one in this time. But just before I went to Ecuador, I met a woman named Catherine Morgan. Catherine Morgan was a missionary in Colombia, South America, where her husband had died. He died under rather suspicious circumstances, and most of us believe to this day that he was murdered. But at any rate, they were missionaries there, and she had four little girls. I think the oldest was about six or seven when her husband died. And he died in the States. They had come back to the States to try to find medical help. And the murder was probably that he'd been fed ground glass, which was working a long, slow process of starvation in him. At any rate, he died in the States, and Catherine picked up her four little girls and went back to Colombia, and she is still down there. She is now, I think, 84. And she's a full-time missionary, lives in Bogota by herself, probably one of the most dangerous cities in the world because of the drug traffic there. And Catherine's daughter lives right near my daughter in Mission Viejo, and she tells me that her mother is still going strong. And just to give you a little hint, I think I have some of her week schedule in my head. Talk about a spiritual mother for the life of the world. Here's this lady who teaches one Bible class in her home per week and another Bible class in somebody else's home. She has a constant stream of people coming to the door asking for prayer and counseling. She has endless telephone calls asking the same thing. She has several people that she's trying to help get off drugs. She visits prisoners every week. And in her spare time, she goes to the old folks' home and visits the old folks. Traveling on the bus, she doesn't drive a car. And Catherine Morgan, if she were here, she would just be the most humorous and utterly just ordinary down-to-earth person. I mean, you would never have any idea that she was a spiritual giant, and she would snort at the idea of such a thing. But Catherine was really almost single-handedly responsible for booting me to Ecuador. She just started the ball rolling, and before I knew what was happening, I was on the boat on my way to Ecuador. And when one day Catherine turned on her radio and happened to hear, while she was there in Colombia, that five American missionaries were lost in the jungle, she glued her ear to the radio to listen while they gave the names, and three of the five names were very familiar to her. And that night she got in her dreadfully beat-up old pickup truck, and she drove over the world's worst roads from Colombia down to Ecuador, where we five wives were awaiting word of the fate of our husbands. And she was there when we learned that our husbands were all dead, and she just began to take over the diaper washing and the baby feeding and feeding all these guests that swarmed down there to try to help us. And Catherine is just that kind of a person. Now, I'm sure that probably in a very simple way, and something that she would never talk about, I think it would be very difficult to get her to talk about it if possible at all. But she just committed herself to the Lord and said, "I'll do anything you say." And like Amy Carmichael, he said, "Thou shalt have words, but thou must first be burnt." And this is going to be true for all of us. Any mother knows when she looks at that precious, beautiful little package that's laid in her arms for the first time, that that little person has the power to rake her soul with pain. And as Mary learned from the old prophet Simeon, a sword would pierce her soul. And of course it did, not once but many times. Motherhood is a high and holy calling. There is no higher, no holier calling, and I believe that it is the calling that all of us have. To you who are mothers in the biological sense, don't listen to what the world is telling you. Just shut your ears. I'm so sick of hearing about young women being told that if they really want to find fulfillment, that the thing to do is to get out of the house and get themselves a job so that you can be self-assured and self-actualized and have self-esteem and a sense of self-worth. Because what possible fulfillment can there be in the washing of diapers and the wiping of little runny noses and the pouring out of endless glasses of juice and the reading of thousands of stories and all the rest of those silly little things that are okay, you know, but they're just for kids. And I mean, who could ever feel fulfilled in that? Remember Jesus' word, "Inasmuch as you've done it for one of the least of these, my brothers, you've done it for me." I'm not sure whether my daughter and two granddaughters are here this morning or not. Are you, Val? There she is. And two granddaughters, Elizabeth and Christiana. Hi. Okay, Elizabeth, you won't mind if I tell this story, then, I'm sure. About the time I asked you to give Evangeline a bottle. Can I tell that story? This wasn't very long ago, just I think last fall or maybe last Christmas. And Val said to Elizabeth, who's 11, would you please give Evangeline her bottle? And Elizabeth is wonderful with Evangeline. I noticed this yesterday. There were just the three of us home. Mama had gone, and so Evangeline was wailing and screaming for Mama, and the last person in the world she wanted to see was Granny, but she did settle down when Elizabeth came along. So Elizabeth sort of sighed and rolled her eyes a little bit, and she said, I think I've given her about 1 million bottles. Well, she couldn't have given her that many, because Evangeline was breastfed, as were all the rest of the children, but she had given her a few bottles, I guess. But she did it, of course. And I couldn't resist a grandmotherly word of exhortation, and I said, now, Elizabeth, if that was the baby Jesus, do you think you might feel differently about it? And she sighed again, and she sort of rolled her eyes, and she said, I guess so. Well, yesterday we had a lovely afternoon, and we talked about some things, and I asked her about what she wanted me to pray for her for, about. But it is a high and holy calling, and when you give a bottle to a baby, or when you wash a diaper, those words of Jesus are specifically applicable. In as much as you have done it for one of the least of these, my brothers, you've done it for me. And he will never forget. And in as much as you have not done it for one of these, you have not done it to me. You remember when Jesus was talking about when I was in prison, you visited me. When I was sick, you came to me. When I was hungry, you fed me. And the listeners, they said, when did we ever go to prison to see you? When did we ever see you hungry? When did we ever put clothes on you? And that was his answer. If you did it for him, you did it for me. If you did it for her, you did it for me. If you did it for one of the least of these, you did it for me. That is what motherhood is about. We're called to be mothers. And may God give us the vision of the invisible. Because it's very easy, isn't it, to get completely taken up with the dirty clothes and the dirty house and the beds that need to be made and the children that need to be given instructions, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little and there a little. Over and over and over again. Put your napkin in your lap. Keep your left hand off the table. Hold your fork properly. Pick up your toys. Put things away. Don't put sticky fingers on the windows. I mean, life for a mother is endless nagging, isn't it? That's really what it amounts to. But we're meant to be mothers. These children need us. The world needs us. And to you grandmothers, do you think of the solemnity of the responsibility that you have to pray for those children? What a world they're growing up in. Isn't it scary? It would be enough to terrify all of us to think of what our grandchildren are facing. But be of good cheer, Jesus said. I have overcome the world. I'm in charge. Underneath are the everlasting arms. The eternal God is thy refuge. And that is never going to change. As the mountains are round about Jerusalem, so the Lord is round about them that fear him. His tender mercies are over all his works. And underneath are the everlasting arms. Is that a safe place to be? Do you know any other? God is our refuge. Mothers, make him your refuge. We are meant to be peacemakers. How often does a mother have to sort out conflict in her house? And my mother always separated the two that were in conflict and would take us aside and get our separate stories. So that one person, if the two were together, of course, one would be interrupting and saying, yes, but he. And as soon as we said, but he, she would stop and say, I don't want to hear what he did. I want to hear what you did. And I know another mother who has put her children on the same sofa and made them sit there in harmony for a while, and Amy Carmichael actually tied the two pigtails together of two girls that couldn't get along. There's a suggestion for some of you. Peacemakers. We're meant to bring peace to the home. And if there's peace in the home, there'll be peace in the world. If there's no peace in the home, there's no peace in the world. And where does this peace come from? Romans 8 says to be spiritually minded. If we're spiritually minded, it's life and peace. Mothers need to be spiritually minded. Constantly looking beyond the visible to the invisible. We have to look at both, don't we? Very carefully and very unflinchingly. We look at the reality. We look at the dirt. We look at the disobedience. We look at the spirit of rebellion. Honestly. And we look at the one who is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we could ask or think. I very often pray that prayer of the whole long prayer of Ephesians 3 for all of my grandchildren and my daughter and her husband. And I love those words. Now to him who is able to do infinitely more than we ever dare to ask or imagine. And I have a very vivid imagination, and I can dare to ask all kinds of things. And God is able to do infinitely more than that according to the power at work within you. That power is at work within me. And I think how utterly, utterly powerless I feel. And there are all kinds of things that I want to change and want to help Valerie with. And every time I go out there, she come out here, I should say. I forget where I am. She wants my advice, bless her heart. Can you imagine a mother of a family like that actually coming to her own mother and saying, now tell me, what shall I do? Or tell me what you see me doing wrong or something. And I don't see her doing a whole lot of things wrong, but I do try to help her with suggestions. We have to look at the reality. But at the same time, we know that there is another level altogether on which those things are controlled. And another level altogether in which we will see what God wants to see in that home and in those children. Now, some of you, I'm sure, come from homes, you grew up in homes which were not Christian homes. I'm sure that's true of many of you. You don't have the experience of growing up in a home such as I did, and for which I thank God. My parents were 7-day-a-week Christians, and we had prayer in our home with the whole family together twice a day, after breakfast and after dinner. We were also tucked into bed and prayed for again by each of our parents, one or the other, each night, up until we were probably 8 or 10 years old. I thank God for that, but that's a rarity nowadays, isn't it? And so we need lots of wisdom, godly wisdom. Remember, when you feel overwhelmed by the job that God has given you to do, and motherhood is an overwhelming thing, that you only have one thing to do. There's only one thing to do, and that's the will of God. Now, what is the will of God for you next? You have to do the next thing. Now, what is that? Well, maybe it's wash the dishes, put the baby to bed, read a story to somebody, whatever that little thing may be, that is the will of God. And I am not at all convinced that God sees any difference at all between writing a Christian book, singing a Christian song, speaking to a group of women like this, or washing a diaper, reading a story to a baby. It's all a part of his assignment, isn't it? And I think the chances are very good that many of you are going to be way up there ahead of me when I get to heaven. You who think, well, I don't have any gifts. I really can't do anything very well. I can't sing, and I can't speak, and I can't write, and I'm not the hostess with the mostest, and I can't even run my own household very well, and I'm not sure I have my children under control, and I sure hope you're not going to come and look in my back closet or in the trunk of my car to find out how disorderly I really am. If you give yourself to God, God can work miracles. Something beautiful, something good, all my confusion, he understood. All I had to offer him was brokenness and strife. But he said he made something beautiful of my life. And the key is to be spiritually minded. Not Eve, who says that she refuses the given, who says, be it unto me according to my will be done. Independence, defiance, ambition, opposition. But Mary, here I am, Lord, do anything you want with me. Dependence. And when you say that, God will show you the next thing to do. If there's one little area of reservation in your spiritual life, you've been growing by leaps and bounds in this wonderful Bible class that you come to, but you're hoping that the Lord is not going to open that particular little tiny cupboard in your life because that's just yours. And you don't want him examining that. Well, if there's something like that, he will give you the grace to deal with it. He will supply the grace and the strength for one day at a time. And there may be somebody here this morning who is unexpectedly expecting. And you're not very happy about this. And I've had a couple of letters recently from radio listeners because I did some programs on unwanted pregnancies. And I thought I'd read you one or two of these. Your topic today was of special interest to me as I drove about doing errands with my 3-year-old and my 14-month-old daughter in the back seat. We discovered this past fall that our third child would arrive in June. We had not closed the door to more children, but the timing of this one was definitely not in our plans. As we had just made a move to a smaller home, hoping to build another home this year, my reaction to the news, though it shocked and numbed me for several days, was not the same as the woman whose letter you read. I had read the letter of a woman who was so devastated she was considering an abortion. I sense a new awareness of God's sovereignty in our lives, an overruling of our plans for His, and there is a tremendous peace in that. My wonderful husband's response to the outcome of the pregnancy test over the phone was, well, we did what we could to prevent it, but God just insists on blessing us. It's a wonderful husband, isn't it? She says, when we announced our upcoming child at a family get-together, one would have thought we had just announced a divorce. It's upsetting to see how our society's anti-child, zero population growth propaganda has crept into the church. Well, I thank God for a church like this that stands for the family. And I had another letter, another lady unexpectedly expecting. She said, I thought I was alone in my struggle. Surely every other married Christian woman wants their pregnancy, but at age 39, no medical insurance, in debt, unstable work conditions, and one stepson yet to raise, 17 years old, I felt devastated when I discovered I was pregnant. All these years, I had never been pregnant. Just when I thought we could start paying off some of the debt, which has horrendous interest, just when I thought only one kid left to feed and clothe, college, etc., just when I thought, and she puts dot, 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 my husband did not want me to keep the baby. He had just finished a side job and actually had enough cash for an abortion. Did I have to choose between my husband and the Lord? What painful, difficult days they were. Thank God I feared the Lord more than I feared losing my husband and family, more than I feared a high-risk pregnancy. The past 9 months have been a constant battle, including the move from one state to another and a 2-month separation from my husband in the middle of my pregnancy. And she quotes a verse that I would never have thought of in this context. Psalm 126, 6. He that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. I have wept a great deal over the past 9 months. I've heard this scripture explained a couple of different ways, but to me, it means I made the right choice. And what seems to have been meant for evil will be turned to good. I'm a week past due. I wrote to this lady and said, please let me know about the outcome. I'm a week past due, very uncomfortable and anxious to know I have a healthy baby. My husband's attitude has completely changed, and I think this baby could be a tool the Lord is using to change my husband. My relationship to my stepson has improved 500% since I've been pregnant. God has provided medical care, a crib, and all the baby clothes I need. I'm still struggling a little with the coming change of lifestyle, but I am thankful and praising the Lord. To be spiritually minded is life and peace. And I'm sure that we could hear many, many testimonies this morning of how through one small act of obedience, which seemed to you a high risk, and you thought you knew some of the disasters that might result from that act of obedience, and yet God has done the unthinkable. I'm sure this woman could never have imagined that a pregnancy was going to improve her relationship to her stepson 500%. We never know what God has up his sleeve, do we? We just don't know. Yesterday, Elizabeth and I were reading a lovely little story from an old 19th century book that Valerie got for her birthday, which happened to be on Wednesday. And it was a little story of a girl who had sung that beautiful hymn by Francis Ridley Havergal, "Take My Life and Let It Be." And the two lines, "Take my hands and let them move at the impulse of thy love," she had taken for her own, and she had written them down, and she had made up her mind that from now on her hands were going to be used for Jesus. And so in the morning she had gotten up and made a list of all the things that she was going to do for Jesus with her hands that day. And she was going to carry some invitations around for something to do with the church, and she was going to make some things for some poor people, and she was going to help with a missionary project for Alaska, and a long list of lovely things that she was going to do for Jesus. Well, it turned out that somebody that was going to come in to help take care of the baby was sick and wasn't going to be able to come. And so the mother said, "I'm sorry, but you won't be able to go to the missionary meeting today. Would you please take care of your little brother?" And so this little girl spent the entire day doing things which were not on her list. There was not one single thing on that list that she was able to accomplish. And she had to get the little boy doll, and she had to put him in the red outfit, and then in the green outfit, and then in the blue outfit. And then when the little boy got tired of the boy doll, then he wanted her doll, and so she got her doll out, and she had to put her in the gold outfit, and the white outfit, and this outfit, and that outfit. And then she had to read him a story, and then he wanted to play a game with stacking your hand, your fists up, you know, and you can imagine how boring this would be for a little girl holding her little brother. And there was one of those quaint woodcut illustrations of the little boy sitting on his sister's lap doing this hand thing, which to him was just fascinating. And do it again, do it again, do it again, do it again. And she felt so sad that she hadn't been able to do anything for Jesus. And when her mother came home, she overheard her aunt, who lived in the house, say to the mother, "Why, that child is just amazing. I never once saw her lose patience with her little brother today." And the mother said, "Well, I think she understands that when she takes care of her little brother, she's doing it for Jesus." And the little girl listened with amazement because she didn't understand that at all. Motherhood. It's what we're called to do. Called to be available. Called to do the dirty job. How many times you've heard men say, "Well, I can change diapers just as well as my wife can, but don't give me the dirty ones." And the only reason that a man can say that is because he has a choice, usually. A woman never has a choice. So what is your list? Is it Eve's list or is it Mary's? "Be it unto me according to thy word." And the last thing, and you've gotten lost in your outline, I forgot to give you my points. Number one in the first talk was two archetypal mothers. Number two was we are made to be receivers. Number three was single women, single mothers. Number four, which is what I've been talking about now in this second section, is mothers. A high and holy call to sacrifice. And now we get to number five. I want to speak particularly to you older women like me. You know what Titus 2, 3 to 5 tells us that we are supposed to be doing. If you go to this church, I'm sure you've heard it. Older women are to teach the younger women to be loving mothers, to love their children, to love their husbands, to stay home, to be temperate, self-controlled, pure, kind, respecting the authority of their husbands. I'm just giving this off the top of my head. I didn't open my Bible. But it is our solemn responsibility as older women to be teaching younger women, not by Bible classes. That's not what Paul had in mind here. Not that there's anything wrong with Bible classes, but obviously we can't all do that. We are all called to set an example. And we teach by example much more loudly than we'll ever teach by words. The medium is the message. What are you? What kind of a woman are you? And when the younger child looks at the older woman, what does she see? And now I want to suggest that every woman in this room is an older woman. If you're 11 years old, you might have a 9-year-old sister that's looking up to you. And Elizabeth does have a 9-year-old sister, and she's got a 4-year-old sister, and she has a 2-year-old sister. And I can remember when I was 9 years old looking up to my 15-year-old next-door neighbor, Ruth Ritchie. And I thought Ruth Ritchie was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen, and she was a full-grown adult as far as I was concerned. I wanted to look like Ruth Ritchie and do my hair like Ruth Ritchie and walk like Ruth Ritchie and dress like Ruth Ritchie and talk like Ruth Ritchie and be everything that I could possibly be exactly like Ruth Ritchie, because that, to me, was a lady. Now, I'm sure that Ruth Ritchie never in her wildest dreams imagined that the little next-door neighbor, 9 years old, was scrutinizing everything about her. But you're all older women. If you're 20, remember that the 14-year-old is looking up to you. If you're 60, remember that the 40-year-old may need you desperately. If you're 40 years old, somebody 20 years old who's just beginning her family and just trying to cope with all the overwhelming responsibilities of motherhood may need you desperately. Are you available? Catherine Morgan was available to me. Catherine Morgan is available to prisoners and drug addicts and old folks and people who need prayer and counseling and a shoulder to cry on. She's there. And when I was a college student, I had the great privilege of being in the dormitory of which Catherine Cumming was the director. And it just so happens that 4 out of the 5 spiritual mothers that I would like to tell you about are named Catherine. I don't have time to tell you about all of them. My own mother's name was Catherine, and of course she's at the top of the list of spiritual mothers. But Catherine Cumming was a single woman from Georgia. And she had become a Christian when she was, I think, in her early 20s, and was completely disinherited by her millionaire family because she became a Christian. She had been reared in a beautiful home in Augusta with white pillars. She had been trained to be nothing but a beautiful, charming Southern belle. She had no skills. I don't think she had a college education. She had no idea what she could do to work to support herself, and I don't really know what she did before she became a house mother at Wheaton College, but I was one of the very fortunate girls who was in her dormitory. And she and I became very dear friends somehow or other. I don't know why in the world I had that privilege, but she told me one time that she just didn't feel as though there was any great age barrier between us. I suppose she must have been 55 or 60. She was extremely elderly to me. And she was also my Sunday school teacher, so we used to walk from the dormitory to church every day, every Sunday. And she used to tell me her troubles, and she was a little short, dumpy woman with this, what shall we say, very ample figure. And she had a very charming way of clasping her very ample bosom when she talked. And one day, I went in and she said, "Oh, Betty." And she called me Betty, as everybody did when I was in college. And with that Southern accent, it becomes Betty. "Oh, Betty, I came to Wheaton to be a spiritual counselor. But here I am, carrying mops and toilet paper across the campus." Now that made a deep impression on me. She was a spiritual counselor to me and to hundreds of other girls. But the impact of her spiritual counseling was infinitely more powerful than it would ever have been if she had not been willing to carry mops and toilet paper across the campus. It was that spirit of humility. Now, this was a woman, mind you, who had never carried mops and toilet paper in her own home in her life. They were surrounded with servants. And she was feeling so let down, just like the little girl who wanted to use her hands for Jesus. Here was this older woman who really wanted to be a spiritual counselor, and she didn't have a whole lot of time for that because she was constantly being called because the toilets were overflowing or they were out of toilet paper or they needed to mop something. Well, years later, I visited Miss Cumming in the retirement home in Florida where she was then staying. And I reminded her of what she had said to me that day. And she blushed to the roots of her white hair. And she clasped her bosom, no longer nearly so ample, and she said, "Oh, Betty, did I really say that?" And I said, "Yes, that's exactly what you said." And then I proceeded to tell her what it had meant to me. And she said, "To think of the mercy of God, that He allowed me to carry mops and toilet paper for His sake." Now, what is motherhood? She was single. Catherine Morgan was a widow. They didn't have to be mothers in the physical sense. And then there was my dear Canadian mom. Do I have 2 minutes left? When I was a lonely student in a Bible school way out on the prairies of Alberta, feeling very cut off from everything and very much a fish out of water, there was a knock on my door in the dormitory one day, and I opened the door to see this radiant face, pink cheeks, beautiful smile, frame of white fluffy hair. And she said, "Are you Betty Howard?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "You don't know me, dear. But I've been praying for you." She was a Scottish lady, as you can guess. "And my name is Mrs. Cunningham. And if you ever feel a bit lonely, and you'd like a cup of Scottish tea and a Scottish scone, just pop down to my little apartment." And she told me where the apartment was. And so you can be sure that many a bitter winter afternoon, when I was feeling very lonely and very much in need of a mother, I popped down to Miss Cunningham's little basement apartment, tiny, tiny little apartment, and she brewed up a pot of Scottish tea and heated up a few of her delicious Scottish scones, and we talked, and she would open her Bible and pray with me, and give me the scriptures, and I think the one verse that I think she must have given me dozens of times, I think she wrote it in every letter she ever wrote to me for years after that until she died, Romans 15:13, "May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing." I'm sure Mrs. Cunningham looked right through me and saw that I was a girl who desperately needed the God of hope and joy and peace, because I was born melancholic, I guess, according to my temperament. And she was always there. And so, I've been blessed by women who knew that they were meant to be mothers and made themselves available for me. I want to go back to that illustration from Lilius Trotter that the death blow precedes the fruit bearing. The leaves must wither. The outward form must die in order that the life may be real in us. And Paul uses exactly that metaphor in 2 Corinthians 4. Death works in me and life in you. I bear in my body the death of Jesus, that the life also of Jesus might be manifest in my mortal flesh. We are meant to be mothers. Death is the precedes life. Life comes out of death. Are you willing to be broken bread and poured out wine for the life of the world? God bless you.